Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They call it California dreaming on global warming. Some mean a compliment by that. Some mean a diss. 2 weeks ago, Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and California's Democratic State Assembly shook hands on an ambitious plan to cut the state's CO2 emissions 25% by 2020. That's huge. By far, the country's most ambitious attack on greenhouse gases.
This is a historic agreement that we have made yesterday to fight global warming, to protect our environment, and that makes California not only the leader in America, but makes us the leader in the world on fighting global warming and protecting our environment.
Proponents have cheered a clarion call to bold action that they say will put the Golden State way out front on new energy technologies. Opponents have sneered that it's feel-good environmentalism on a grand scale that will break the bank. Up next on Point, California places a big bet against global warming. We will hear from voices in California and beyond this hour, and from the Speaker of the California State Assembly, who was a driving force behind passage of the bill. But first, for the basics and the latest, we turn to Mark Lifshear, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's been covering the story. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So we heard the Assembly has passed it. Has Schwarzenegger signed it? Is he going to?
He hasn't signed it yet. He has 30 days from when it passed, but he is going to sign it. He said he's going to sign it, and he's been a supporter all along.
What exactly will this bill require of California?
Well, it will empower the State Air Resources Board, which already acts against pollutants in the air, to study the emissions of greenhouse gases, make an inventory of them, create a baseline for various industries and different sectors, mainly electric power plants, refineries, other heavy industries, cement manufacturers, and then beginning in 2012 to put quotas on the various emitters, and they will have until 2020 to slowly ratchet down to those levels.
To cut 25% or back to 1990 levels, we read, California, you report, Mark, is the world's, as a state, is the world's 12th largest emitter of greenhouse gases, responsible for 10% of the carbon dioxide produced nationally, 2.5% of global emissions. What does it matter if California succeeds? I mean, it's going to be hard to succeed, but if it does it make a difference in global warming?
It won't make a big difference in terms of the worldwide amount of carbon emissions, because California already is quite efficient. We've already become quite technologically advanced, and we only produce 2.5%. But what's hoped is, in light of the lack of action on the federal government's part and on the part of Congress and the president, that California, as it has so many times in the past on environmental and other issues, will show the rest of the country and indeed the rest of the world that something can be done. And if they follow California, as they have on many other issues, then there could be some good results.
The Golden State has put a big challenge on the table for itself here. Give us some sense of the politics in this, Mark Lifshear, with Governor Schwarzenegger and beyond. What were the arguments for and against this bill?
Well, Schwarzenegger, he is a Republican governor, but he's always considered himself an environmentalist. Early on, in June of 2005, he said he wanted to do something about global warming. He created a climate action team to study it, to come up with recommendations. About a year later, they did come up with recommendations. And about that time, the Speaker of the Assembly, Mr. Nunez,
who we'll hear from in just a moment, I should say,
and Fran Pavley, Assemblywoman, came up with a bill that largely sought to put into law what the governor was talking about with some differences. That started almost a year-long negotiating process or legislative process as the bill was crafted, as it wended its way through the Assembly and the Senate. And in the end, they, after some differences and a little bit of horse trading or a lot, they came to agreement and they passed the bill that the governor said he'll sign.
And what about beyond Sacramento? Who lined up for and against this? We see reports that sort of the high-tech investment community was for it, but some in business and certainly in the energy business had and have real doubts about the cost.
Well, mainline kind of traditional industries, certainly oil refineries and oil companies, some heavy industries, big box stores that use a lot of electricity, have been worried that California, which already has some of the highest electricity rates in the country, that those rates could go even higher. At the same time, they worried that businesses would just move to a nearby state or another country, and they'd still be polluting greenhouse gases that go into the global atmosphere, but California's economy would be losing out. On the other hand, another element of business, as you mentioned, Silicon Valley people, venture capitalists, even some big utility companies like Pacific Gas and Electric, they decided that this actually might be good for the economy as well as the environment, and they have studies from UC Berkeley that show that tens of thousands of jobs and billions of dollars of economic growth would be generated.
So maybe it can be an advantage, but fear that it could be a problem. Is California counting on others to pick up this torch? I mean, if it does this alone, is it going to look like a sacrifice without impact?
Yes, all the supporters here, the environmentalists, including the big national environmental groups like Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense, who are sort of East Coasters, they sought a deal in California as a way of showing Washington that something can be done and to have a victory. And it was already, I noticed on Google this morning that the state of Arizona, the governor there has already ordered the state to begin doing some things about global warming.
Finally, Mark, Californians have been looking at the potential impact of global warming if it's not slowed down. What are scientists saying about, just in the case of California alone, what we might see if the temperature continues to creep up?
Well, obviously, we're a state of close to 38 million people, and it doesn't rain between May and October. So the state is totally dependent on water that comes down in the form of snow during the winter in the Sierras, and then is captured and stored and delivered through an incredibly complex plumbing system from the north of the state to the south of the state. So obviously, we could be in big trouble if there was less of a snowpack, if it melted too soon.
You're talking about the Sierra Nevada snowpack declining as much as 90%.
Yes, and it also could have an impact on the forests, on the coast, on tourism, just a lot of things that make California, California.
So California taking steps on its own that it hopes others will join. Mark Lifshear at the L.A. Times, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
I want to turn now to Sacramento, and the Speaker of the California State Assembly, Fabian Nunez, joins us. He's Democratic State Representative from Los Angeles, a big mover behind this big new step on global warming from one state. Mr. Nunez, Speaker Nunez, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
How did you get California behind this move? It may cost a lot.
Well, you know, I would say that even though negotiations at times were tense, this was easier to do than I originally thought, because the growing awareness among voters in this state, and I would argue around the country, that global warming is a real crisis that needs to be dealt with immediately, has raised the level of awareness about that fact among voters. I think it's a reality that we cannot ignore. And obviously, you know, there was a public poll done by the Public Policy Institute of California that showed 74% to 75% support among voters for this. So it you know, obviously made it a little bit easier for us to move this bill through the process, even though I think we only got one Republican vote In the Senate and Assembly, which consists of 120 members of the legislature.
The Wall Street Journal went after the whole program. It says this is feel-good environmentalism, just political symbolism, and notes that you've left an escape hatch here, that if the state is facing a threat of significant economic harm, you could jettison the thing. Feel-good environmentalism, Mr. Speaker?
Well, I mean, on the one end, the Wall Street Journal says in their editorial that it's feel-good environmentalism, and then it said it's bad for the economy. So which is it? If it's only feel-good environmentalism, then why is it that a lot of folks from different sectors, those that are the largest emitters of carbon gases, are the ones opposing this bill? Because they think we have some very strict requirements here. Look, let's not forget, California is the 12th largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, and obviously, you know, the top four or five are way at the top, and there's a big gap between them and the rest of the world. But we are the sixth largest economy in the world, and we believe in California that we need to take the positive step forward to show that this can be done, that we can in fact do this and have a strong economy at the same time. We have a study from UC Berkeley that indicates that we're going to generate over 17 million jobs in just 9 years in the area of innovation and development of alternative green technologies and green fuels. And so all of this is important in the context of everything that we've done in this state, the leadership that we've taken in the past, for example, on clean air emissions as well as tailpipe emissions. I think California has demonstrated some leadership, and every time we've done something like that, the business world has come to us and said, oh, California's economy is going to collapse, and never has that happened. And so we believe that this will only work for California if other states begin to follow suit, and eventually leading to the federal government doing the right thing.
You think that's going to happen? Do you see signs that it may break your way on that front?
I think it's going to break our way. It's inevitable. The public sentiment is such that people want change. People realize that this is about our sustainability.
Speaker Nunez, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking this hour about California taking on global warming, one big state stepping up and hoping that others do the same. Let's listen here to Governor Schwarzenegger on August 31st speaking to California high school students a day after the Assembly passed this big bill.
People said you can only be pro-environment or you can be pro-business, but we have proven that we can do both. And this now, by fighting global warming, will create all kinds of new industries and will create hundreds of thousands of new jobs. I'm very proud of that. And I'm also very proud of all of you. Thank you very much, and I'll be back. Thank you.
He'll be back. He said, we want to learn more about this program. Let's look at it more closely. From California, Daniel Kamen joins us. He's director of Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley. Been an advisor and analyst on a range of greenhouse gas control strategies to the California Assembly. Daniel Kamen, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, too.
And with us from Washington, Eileen Clausen joins us. She's president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change and Strategies for the Global Environment. Eileen Clausen, thank you for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
Daniel Kamen, first to you. We're looking on from afar here, and it looks like there's a lot of latitude left on how California actually accomplishes this 25% cut in emissions. What's it going to take? How's it likely to be done?
Well, actually, I'm glad the latitude is there. And the way the rulemaking is set on this is that the California Air Resources Board, that has a lot of experience in dealing with air quality issues from local smog to regional things, has now a few years to set out a number of standards. Some of the standards related to given industries. There will be a standard for electric power generation. In fact, as we heard in the opening segment, Pacific Gas and Electric, our major utility, one of the major utilities, has signed on as a supporter of this. And there'll be restrictions on different sectors. But then the critical mechanism that many of us are looking towards is there will be a trading scheme. There'll be a market set up so that companies that have carbon credits to sell can sell those, and those companies that choose not to partake in the innovation game and just want to buy the credits to sort of meet their obligation can do that.
Cap and trade, I believe that's often called. Is that what you're talking about here? And how does that really work?
Right.
Carbon credits to sell, meaning what?
Well, we actually do this already for many other pollutants in the country where industry that cleans up, makes itself cleaner relative to its baseline, gets credits that it puts in the bank. other companies that may need to buy those credits because they've either grown without cleaning up or they just decided not to go on the innovation route, just to pay for their emissions, can then buy those credits. And there's a great deal of economic theory and practice that indicates this is a very efficient way to manage all manner of things, from water quality issues to giving out hunting license to sulfur dioxide, other emissions.
So you put a market dynamic to work for you there. What about energy costs in California? They're already quite high. Are they likely to get a lot higher as a result of this legislation?
Well, interestingly enough, they're actually likely to stay the same or decline somewhat, which may sound counterintuitive, but what this will do, it will bring in new actors into the game. We already have quite a few fossil fuel power plants, gas-fired power plants. We buy hydropower from the Northwest. We have two nuclear plants. What this will do, this will accelerate the building in-state or near California, likely of solar and wind and biomass. And this diversity of supply is the best medicine you can get to prevent the kind of price spikes we've sometimes seen, like in the recent gas markets. So over time, we expect this will actually decrease the prices, which again, to some sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but in fact has proven time and time again.
Eileen Clausen in Washington, how are you looking at this? Critics say sneeringly, look, even if California reaches these big goals, and they left an escape hatch for themselves, but even if they pull it off, it only reduces global emissions by 0.3%. So is this a big deal or not?
Yes, it's a very big deal. I mean, if you really want to tackle this problem on a global basis, you really need, let's say, the 25 top emitters in the world who account for about 83-84% of global emissions. California would be well within that if it was a country on its own. So nobody should sneer at the emissions levels in California or at the ambition of this piece of legislation.
And what about the notion that California may actually economically benefit from this? You know, high-tech investors out there saying we could get out front on the alternate energy future here and cash in big. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Yeah, it sounds absolutely reasonable. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be some losers in this, because I think when you do anything this sweeping, there are both winners and losers.
Losers like who?
You could argue that some in oil or coal, depending upon how this is implemented, might be losers here. But we do need new fuels. We do need new ways of generating and using energy. And there is going to be a big market for this on a global basis.
Will California drive businesses out of the state because energy prices, you know, may be an open question there?
I don't think so. And I don't think so because I think other states will follow California's lead, which has happened in other areas. And I also think that we are only a few years away from national legislation. And this California bill will help push us there.
We're going to hear in a moment from a critic of the new program, but I want to hear from our listeners as well. Doug is calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
I just wanted to applaud California for taking a step forward on this. I'm sure that everybody's conscious about the atmosphere, you know, the environment. And I only wanted to comment that I'm really disappointed that the federal government, particularly the president, hasn't stepped forward to see the importance of this for the American people and the rest of the world and taken a leadership role in this. Thank you.
Doug, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Let's get another from South Windsor, Connecticut. Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
We're well. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think that there's some great potential for good things to happen from this, as evidenced by what I've personally seen in the automotive industry, where catalytic converter technology and emissions controls from the clean air legislation has created industries, has made the United States more competitive, and actually has caused some export of that technology.
So you say this could be an economic winner, maybe not just for California, but beyond. Let us look at that. Dan Kamen, there's calls from Alabama and Connecticut applauding California. I guess two questions here. Number one, is there a dynamic in what California has done that sort of compels other states or the federal government to follow? Or are you relying, let me ask you first, on hope, on inspiration, on people being inspired by what you've done? Or is there actually kind of leverage being applied here?
Well, I certainly think that good legislation, as this is, should inspire not just lawmakers, as we've seen this Democratic-Republican coalition in California passing it, but this has real teeth in it. It's not just a hope and dream sort of bill at all. And in fact, one of the most interesting features is that this will directly impact many neighboring states. We have a Western alliance of states largely pushed by Governor Schwarzenegger here and by Governor Richardson in New Mexico, a coalition of Western states that will likely adopt pieces of this. And even before that happens, California is not an island of power. We get power from all over the region. And critically in this bill, electricity generated in California or out is subject to the same regulations if it's sold into the state of California. Many coal plants, for example, were going to be built in the mountain states to sell power to California. Those plans have now been scaled back. So that's an immediate savings on carbon emissions. It's also a local air quality savings. And with this Western block of states taking action, and there is a New England and Mid-Atlantic states that have similar restrictions on just the power sector, not economy-wide as California has. Mm-hmm. There are some big, powerful blocks that are in cooperation on this that I think is the way this is going to spread nationally. And that's really exciting. It's not a hope and dreams. It's a real economic levers and tools sort of bill.
Eileen Clausen, how do you read the politics on this? Of course, there are still significant skeptics, certainly in the political realm, on global warming and some beyond. Do you see this administration being influenced by what California's done? Is this a bet that's going to wait for administration down the road to respond?
I'm actually assuming that it's another administration. But I think it's worth pointing out that we now have bipartisan interest in the Congress in doing something here. Bills not only by Senators McCain and Lieberman, which was introduced in 2003, but Senator Carper, Senator Bingaman, Senator Feinstein, Congressman Waxman, Senator Jeffords with Senator Boxer have all introduced bills to try to cap emissions. And I think that will get a big push from California, and we're about 3, maybe 4 years away.
Let me get a call from Bristol, Connecticut. Jason's on the line. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm an environmental engineer here in Connecticut. I've taken the time to actually try and get into the global warming thing.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just preface it by saying, as an environmental engineer, I'm totally in favor of reducing CO2 emissions and, in general, strict air pollution control.
Okay.
That being said, I've learned not to listen to the politicians when it comes to the global warming greenhouse gas debate.
Not to listen in which direction?
In any direction.
Mm-hmm.
They are, obviously, they're first and foremost interested in getting themselves reelected, not in climatology.
What about the scientists? I mean, are you a skeptic on global warming, or are you concerned that it's a real deal and happening?
Well, you mentioned the recent report on increased hurricane activity.
Mm-hmm.
Hurricane activity in the Atlantic is dominated by what's called the North Atlantic Oscillation. It's an ocean current. Currently, climatologists say we are in a phase that was similar to the 30s and 40s when we had another cycle of bigger and more hurricanes, and they expect this cycle to last another decade or two.
So you're a skeptic. Do you see much ado about nothing in California's program then, or do you welcome it in any case?
I welcome it. Everybody across the board says California's initiative, as well as Kyoto, will have zero impact on CO2 emissions. That's not a bad thing in my mind, because what it is going to do is drive more efficiency out of our power generation, out of our cars. It's going to drive alternative fuels, but it's not going to impact CO2 emissions. And CO2 emissions have not yet been proven to have any impact on the global temperature.
So applause there from Jason on the efficiency front, a question mark in his corner on the environment.
I'm going to have to disagree, though, with some of the scientific facts.
Yes, Daniel?
Yeah,
I'm going to have to disagree on a number of the facts stated, and that is that the science of hurricanes is still being debated. There's good evidence right now that we are impacting it, but leaving that aside, the litany of not model-based but documented environmental changes linked to human activity is very strong, and there is really no scientific debate. You can debate the politics, but in terms of what the science says about the fact that spring arrives earlier, fall leaves later, that we are seeing dramatic changes in the ice caps, both the temperate ones, the glaciers and the poles, that we see significant changes in ocean chemistry. These aren't scientific speculation. These are a body of now well-established scientific fact. And so the first statement that the the issue of global warming being real or not is really one where the scientific debate is over. Politics will go on, but the science is very clear.
Eileen Clawson, how about it? Can you imagine California being left out on a limb here 10 years from now? We look around and say, oh, you know what, it's not global warming after all, and California's, you know, been in a great sweat for no reason?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think there is a real scientific consensus on this. There are some unanswered questions, and I'm not going to say there are no uncertainties here, but the real scientific debate has progressed well beyond the point needed to justify action, and I don't think there is any chance that California is going to be left out on a limb.
I want to welcome a critical voice on the California legislation from Dallas, Texas. We're joined by Dr. Margot Thorning, Senior Vice President, Chief Economist at the American Council for Capital Formation. Margot Thorning, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
What do you make of the California program?
Well, I think it's a noble attempt, but if you look at the facts, I think it's going to be extremely difficult and quite costly, contrary to what the two previous speakers said. For example, if you look at the California Environmental Protection Agency's own data, they project a sharp increase in baseline emissions of CO2 by 2020.
On the current path, if
on
unchanged.
On the current path. Mm-hmm. And that path includes increased better technology. Their baseline forecast includes that. And then you look at the AB 32 target.
That's the legislation, AB 32, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it requires, looking at the CO2 numbers, that California EPA reduced a 40% reduction in emissions. That's using the CO2, not carbon. Mm-hmm. So that combined with California's own projected strong population growth of approximately 20% between now and 2020, each extra person needs more energy. They may be more mm-hmm. energy efficient all the time, but when you combine the strong forecast for baseline emissions with population growth and the fact that energy prices would have to rise very sharply in the electricity sector, the transport sector, the industrial mm-hmm. sector, to force energy use down. And people talk rather glibly, I think, about renewables making up the difference. Well, the fact is renewables are quite a bit more expensive per kilowatt hour and probably will remain so for the next several decades.
So I want to clarify, are you saying you think it's impossible to achieve this goal or that it's just going to be crushingly costly?
I think it will be virtually impossible because I don't think whoever is in office in 2012 in California when the plan begins to take effect will be able politically to impose taxes high enough or impose targets tight enough to force energy use down because an emission trading fee, which is what a cap and trade system is, would require a carbon permit of, you know, perhaps $200 or $300 a metric ton of carbon, which would raise electricity prices, fuel prices very dramatically, hurting low-income and elderly people, slowing business, and increasing the tendency of business to move elsewhere.
Daniel Kamen, how about it? Has even mighty California bitten off more than it can chew here?
Well, no, I don't think it has, and I'm actually sort of disheartened to hear the pessimism on this, given the fact that in Margot's own state of Texas, it's now become the country leader in producing wind power. It's actually in many places cheaper than natural gas today without this, you know, complicated set of taxes. And so a big part of this bill is actually to open the markets for these already competitive and near competitive renewables. And in fact, we've seen time and time again in the country, in California in particular, that at the times when you open up the market to these cleaner competitors, that actually diversifies your supply, prevents collusion among power producers, and in fact brings down the overall cost of power. And so the EPA, the California EPA study that Ms. Thorning is referring to is actually one that also says there's strong economic consensus from Nobel laureate economists, from state economists all across the board, that with the cap-and-trade system in place, we can expect a long-term stabilization of costs for power in California, which has, up until this point, in fact, been rising quite steadily. So there's actually very good economic arguments, as well as technological innovation, indicating that this is actually an achievable path. And the issue of will we have the political will in 15 years to make it happen, that's largely a function of what we put in place today.
I've been joined from Washington by Eileen Clawson at the Pew Center on Global Climate Change and Strategies, from Dallas, Texas, by a critic of the new program. Margot Thorning is with us at the American Council for Capital Formation, and from Berkeley, California, at the University of California there, Daniel Kamen is with us. Right now, Marilyn is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Marilyn. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm very excited about California taking this action and want to just talk about faith organizations like the Unitarian Universalist Association, which this summer has taken action and has issued a statement of conscience encouraging all congregants to take responsibility personally, in congregations, nationally, to recognize that this science is correct and that we are, it's incumbent upon us to save this planet the way it is nurturing our young, so that indeed it can continue to do so.
Do you see a wave coming out of California that could sway the rest of the country, or is this going to stay out in Lotus Land?
Well, I think that you see, in fact, when exciting, important things happen, I think, in the world, they're happening in various places at the same time.
Mm.
And so this is happening in California. This is happening with Unitarian Universalists. This is happening in Europe. So I see this coming up, not just in one or two places, but all over.
Marilyn, we've got it, and we appreciate it. There's a voice resonating with California's step here and inspired by it. Let me get a call from Providence, Rhode Island. Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm familiar with the ACCF, the group that Dr. Thorning is with.
The American Council for Capital Formation.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was important to note that they're funded largely by ExxonMobil and a host of other organizations that have an incentive to promote, to not be in favor of these alternative energies. For example, I have a list of their 04, 05 supporters. They include Marathon Oil, ExxonMobil, Ford Motor Company, Daimler Chrysler.
That's a pretty head-turning list. Chris, hang on for a second. We've got that. Margo Thorning, how about it? Who are your major backers, and what is their interest in this issue? Yes, please.
We have an energy and climate advisory board of about 25 companies and associations. And, of course,
sounds like we may have lost Margo Thorning in Dallas for a second. Chris, have you gone on down that list?
Let's see. American Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, American Business Conference, American Gas Institute Association, American Petroleum Institute.
So energy, automobile, energy.
Down the line.
Yeah.
Can I say something here?
We'll get Margo back in just a moment. Chris, thanks for your call. Eileen Clausen, what about it?
Yeah, I just want to say that at the Pew Center, we work with 41, mostly Fortune 500 companies. Not the ones on that list, but another set of big companies, including GE and United Technologies and BP and Shell. And we all believe, companies too, that there is something happening here with the climate, that we have to take action on this, and that mandatory requirements are in order.
But you're arguing in the opposite direction from Margo Thorne.
I'm just saying that there are companies who understand that there are opportunities here as well as risks, and that the time to do something is now.
We'll get Margo Thorning back and put the question to here. Let me get a call from Independence, Iowa. George is on the line. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm not an economist, so this might just sort of be speculation, but I've often wondered what the world would be like if we had a nationwide 25-cent gas tax, for example, and then use that revenue to subsidize things like hybrid cars, more energy-efficient automobiles. And I was wondering if the California legislation is designed to target anything like this, or whether maybe there are any plans for increased economic incentives. I mean, kind of like this whole carbon trading thing, but for specifically trying to get increase the incentives for people to buy and companies to make.
Great question. Dan Kamen, what about it?
Well, in fact, this is part of what's being looked at and discussed here. A bill was introduced during this past session by Assemblyman Joe Nathan that was actually defeated. That was exactly what the caller is describing. And it was defeated.
A gas tax, supplementary gas tax?
It was going to be exactly that, a 25-cent gas tax. And it was defeated because the thought was that we'd like to take a more economy-wide look. I actually would have liked to have seen it pass, but understand fully why it didn't get through when we were also discussing AB 32, the bill that did get through, because what we would like to see is using the market as our friend here, in the sense of not picking a couple sectors and penalizing them, but utilizing the market forces to pick and choose between various options. I believe that in part of passing this, California is going to look for other revenue streams. In fact, there is an initiative on California's ballot for the November election. It's called Proposition 87, and it would actually impose a production fee on oil that's pumped in state of – that's found in California and apply that to this sort of fund, to reducing California's gasoline use by a quarter. There are going to be a set of initiatives like this that emerge that will be utilized, some command and control, but many of them market-based, that will fill out not just the funding streams, but also – encouraging innovation in the various different areas of the economy that we are sure to need, not just to meet the rule in the short term, but to make this part of a long-term plan. And Governor Schwarzenegger in 2005 signed an executive order that called not only for this 25% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, but in the long term, by 2050, a full 80% reduction, which is the level that we ecologically believe is going to be required. And not just from California, but globally. But someone's got to step out on it. And California believes, A, we should do it for the moral and the ethical reasons that your caller previously mentioned, but also because there are economic benefits to being an early actor here in terms of capturing that clean tech sector, something we've seen in Denmark with a booming wind turbine industry and in Germany with wind and solar and in Japan with solar as well. So there's good economic arguments why it's good to be the innovator here. And that's what California is doing.
80% by 2050. At that point, you're out in a really radical zone, maybe required, as you say. Dan Kamen, just take us to the nearer horizon of 2020 and this 25% reduction. Try and make it real for us, if you can. I know not all the details are ironed out here yet, but in terms of physical infrastructure and the way people live and the way business is done, by 2020, if this works, how will California be different than it is today? How will it look and feel and behave differently?
Right. Well, there'll certainly be several things. One is that our power meters on your building, on your homes and offices, are likely to become smarter. They replace that sort of 1940s-style dial with the technology in your cell phone so that you will get a signal from utility telling you on a hot summer afternoon, the price of power is rising right now. Do you want to keep air conditioning right at this level, or do you want to turn it down?
Okay.
And in a home like mine that has solar panels on the roof, and by the way, California has also passed legislation and put the funding in place to go from the roughly 30,000 homes that have solar on the roof today to 1 million, and that was endorsed by the governor as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in my home with solar on the rooftop, what my meter will likely do is to say, stop cooling my home and sell this power back to the grid. And so you won't see any big scale changes except for if you look on those solar rooftops. But what you're going to see overall is much more of a market-based structure so that small power companies can ramp up their production of hydro or wind. A large company can curtail some of its air conditioning and sell power back to the grid.
Are you going to have to have a lot more wind and solar to make this work? Are you counting on a huge introduction of renewables here to make this work?
Well, we're counting on a ramp up of renewables, but we are likely to see most of the changes first in terms of greater use of energy efficiency, of which we've demonstrated already that we can do a lot so far and we can do more. But also, we're likely to see much more intelligent market opportunities so that landfills will likely sell more of the waste gas back into the grid. They'll burn it in power plants, they'll use it, and that sawmills will likely make biofuels like ethanol and methanol out of the waste, and we'll use that in our cars. And many more of our cars will not just be hybrids, but will likely be plug-in hybrids, where you drive to work and then you plug in and recharge from solar on the rooftop. And so what we're likely to see is, again, not some, you know, some Blade Runner-esque world, the future that's very different, but we're likely to see a much smarter energy infrastructure where you can buy and sell power. And that really is putting the market to work in your favor, not fighting against every step of the way.
I want to turn back to Dallas. Margot Thorning, do we have you again?
Yes, you do.
Good. We lost you just when a caller was asking about the backing of the American Council for Capital Formation. What about your backers and their interest? What do you say to that?
The backers are very diverse. We have financial sector supporters as well as energy supporters, manufacturing.
But we heard a lot of the list with a lot of energy and a lot of automotive there. So where do their interests lie here?
Their interests lie along with, I'm sure, the supporters of the Pew Foundation and Mr. Kamen's group they lie in reducing greenhouse gas emissions in a cost-effective manner. I think we all agree that we want to try to reduce greenhouse gases and mitigate human impact on the climate. The question is, what is the best way to do it? What is the most cost-effective way that won't unnecessarily constrain economic growth and well-being? Renewables are quite expensive, and the reason Texas has a lot of renewables is that they're mandated by the state, so the cost is passed along to the regular, through the rate to all consumers. And that's true in many states. So it isn't that the market has so much demanded renewables right now, but they've been mandated. Now, in time, I'm sure wind power and solar will be more cost effective, but right now they're not. So the question is, how do we get a handle on global greenhouse gas emissions and how can we slow growth? And let me point out that the European Union, which has implemented an emission trading system last year, is not on track to meet its Kyoto target, and they can't agree on a target for the second commitment period because proponents believe that we need to drive toward an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas.
Right, we heard that. So it's not easy. It's not easy,
and they can't agree on the target. And as far as I can tell, the European experiment is going to be a failure, and why a state would want to go down a path that's almost certain to not produce the goal that they want.
Let me get a call on that from Hamden, Connecticut, if I may. Michael's calling. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to address a question to Ms. Thorney. The idea of all of these economic and political problems having to do with California legislation, I don't understand what she thinks the alternative is. It's one thing to point out the myriad of problems that are involved with reaching these goals, but I would think it would be a little more ethical to say, well, these are the goals that have to be reached. How do we get past these problems? How do we solve these problems? Instead
That's
of pointing
exactly
out what
the
they
point.
Are and throwing yeah. your hands in the air and saying, well, you know, we can't reach them, so why try?
Michael,
well,
we've got it, and I'll put that to Margaret Thorning, but I want to go first to Eileen Clausen because, Eileen, I think I heard you there expressing some sighing dissent to the picture that Margaret Thorning was presenting.
Yes, I mean, I think what she said about the European Union is absolutely wrong.
And
first of all, it is far too easy to say it's not a success, the EU trading system, when it's barely gotten started. It's only been in a pilot phase, and the targets have to be met by 2012. So calling it a failure at this point is in my view, really silly. The second thing is that it's not entirely clear whether the European countries will meet the target or not. Some are on the track and some are not, but there is a lot of time between now and 2012 to see how this all works out. So calling it a failure, I think, is just not honest.
Margaret Thorning, then what about Michael says, hey, if you don't like this idea, what's your proposal?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think the path that the administration is trying to move forward on, and we do spend $6 billion taxpayer dollars every year on climate change and on new technology initiatives. The Asia-Pacific Partnership, which was signed last year with six countries, including China, India, the U.S., Australia, Japan, Korea, and India, is an attempt to encourage economic growth and clean development in a variety of energy fields. And these countries, these six countries, have 54% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So I think focusing on technology transfer and encouraging the economic growth that will pull through the capital stock more quickly, a cleaner, less emitting capital stock, is the best way forward. And I should add that the EU's own Environmental Protection Agency shows that they're not on track to meet their target.
Daniel Kamen, let me bring you in at that point. What do you think, Daniel, about the track, the arc that we're on as a country? Margot Thorning sees some promise there. And in your view, where we need to be, how different and how likely is California's effort to change the direction?
Well, I certainly agree with Margot that we do want to do this in as broad a global context as possible. And so the discussions with the Chinese and Japanese governments are very encouraging, and those should be encouraged. But you do need to have two things. You need to have the stock of technology, and you need to have the stock of experience in putting this into place. Otherwise, you can say, let's have all the meetings you want, but you don't have anything to implement. What we're seeing now in California, and actually in 23 other states, including Texas, that have passed requirements for a certain fraction of their power to come from renewables, the so-called renewables portfolio standards, is one approach. But we know that we need to go beyond just the utility sector. And the California approach is an exceptionally economically sound way to do that. And what's funny is that 15 years ago, we heard economists saying, well, we can't do anything about it because we have to use the market. Now, we're seeing the green movement and the progressive economists thinking about how to do this with improved technologies, the solar, the wind, the biomass, and efficiency, and using the market. And now we're hearing, at least on this call, I haven't heard many like Margot's recently, I have to admit, saying, well, the market isn't going to get us there. We should do nothing. And I think we actually have the ideal combination of a time period with a great deal of technological innovation and Europe, the New England states, California, taking the lead on putting it into place. We're certainly going to see hiccups in the road. We're going to see issues where certain technologies and companies need boosts and we need to address problems that arise. But the best way to solve these problems is to set a clear standard. Like
Dan Kemen, last question here. Our time is short. It goes to you. Can this work with states and regions pitching in, or does it ultimately have to be a national policy? Or could it be an accumulation of state policies that address global warming?
Well, of course, we need a national and then international agreements to make it work overall, because greenhouse gases and their emissions, wherever they come from, it's a global problem. But we often in this country build up federal policy by implementing the best parts of state policy, as has happened many times before. This, I believe, is that first wave in getting good federal policy to come out of really innovative and effective state action.
A big step on the way in California. I want to thank all of my panel for being with us today. In Dallas, Texas, Margot Thorning, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Eileen Clausen at the Pew Center on Global Climate Change and Strategies for the Global Environment. Eileen in Washington, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And Daniel Kamen, Director of Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory at the University of California at Berkeley. Dan Kamen, thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.